Hey, everybody, new sponsor for the show, Magic Drop. Magic Drop is a music licensing business based in Brooklyn, New York, which represents an eclectic roster of bands and composers licensing their music for use in films, TV, and beyond. Magic Drop works directly with clients to find songs or instrumentals from a catalog of 1,000-plus tracks by artists with distinctive developed voices. Magic Drop offers competitive rates and festival licenses for independent filmmakers. Visit magicdropmusic.com or email contact at magicdropmusic.com for more information. Again, that's Magic Drop. I welcome them to the podcast. Radio, and you're listening to episode 410 of the podcast. Thank you for your support. Please do go on Facebook and find us on facebook.com/filmwaxradio and like that, and find us on Instagram and Twitter under @filmwaxradio. Most importantly of all, though, please do subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You just search for Filmwax or Filmwax Radio and hit that subscribe button. Hey, while you're there, leave us a star rating and a review. Means a lot, helps us a great deal, and getting the show up the ranks of iTunes and to the point where maybe people will discover it through searches. So please do that. If you take a moment of time, just pause the podcast and go to iTunes and leave us a nice little review or star rating. Thank you very much for that. Now, with this particular episode of the podcast, we have a couple of great segments. We have a conversation with Andrew Cohen, the director of a new documentary called Night School. The film is really an exceptional documentary, one of the best I've seen in months, and I'm very happy to bring Andrew back. Andrew Cohen was last on episode number 174 back in 2013 with his co-director Davey Rothbart for the film Medora. Now he's back with Night School, and I just want to let you know Davey Rothbart is not involved in this film, but I wanted to mention, since his name has come up, that Davey has his own podcast on the Wondery Network, which is called Found. And if you're not familiar with it and you do like podcasts, I do recommend checking out Found. It's a terrific podcast, and it's doing quite well, I hear. But on this episode, Andrew is back alone. And it's about three adults who are from the inner city of Indianapolis and who must overcome a variety of obstacles to finally earn their high school diplomas. We're not talking about GED diplomas. We're talking about actual high school diplomas. And so they have to overcome so many obstacles, and it's a very, very inspiring film. The film opens in New York City on the 9th of June, which I believe is today. It will be at the IFC Center in New York City as of today, June 9th. Very inspiring. Tickets are available if you go to the IFC Center website and purchase some tickets tonight. For tonight's opening night, Andrew will be there, as far as for what I understand. We'll go into that conversation in just a couple of minutes. And then I'm joined by Leah Sapin, who is the senior programmer for the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which is also beginning this weekend. And I just wanted to mention that because I am a big fan, and I've seen quite a bunch of the films this year that are going to be in the festival. And that, too, begins tonight, Friday the 9th, and goes through Sunday, June 18th, also at the IFC Center and at the Film Society of Lincoln Center. And there are some spectacular scenes. I've already seen Bill Nye, Science Guy. Well, I'll go into the films that I've seen just after this first segment, which is, again, with my friend Andrew Cohen. We recorded this at the offices of the Listening Booth. Here it is. This is my conversation with Andrew.
You guys have a special opportunity that across the country people don't have, to return to high school as an adult and pursue your education.
I wonder if I never had my son, if I would have ever finished school.
I quit my junior year, but I'm just looking at her, looking at her, looking at her.
I told myself by the time I was 26, I was gonna have my life together. Here I am, still trying to get my life together.
About to start in 3, 2, 1.
I see the light
like, it's flashing. I see the other people that made it. I see them at the end waving at me like, come on.
Right now, she has the slightest hope of graduating.
So what, she's an epileptic?
She has epilepsy.
Melissa hasn't been here since last Tuesday.
It's getting harder as it go time go longer. It's getting harder. I didn't never know that it was going to be this much of a struggle.
Kid that I so oh, yeah, tell me the story. You were going to start. Andrew Cohen, director of, you may know Andrew from such hits as Medora in High School. Go ahead.
I was just saying, I just got a text from this kid that I've been mentoring a long time ago. Someone said
Work-wise?
Work-wise, okay, yes, good. Yes. Work-wise, I've been kind of mentoring him. He's an aspiring filmmaker in Indianapolis. I met him when I was in night school.
Great.
And he, you know, these, you know, younger guys, it just, do you ever have anyone you looked up to when you were a kid that you just latched onto? Like, you weren't leaving them alone no matter what? Like, he somehow
Dad?
Found his, yeah, he's,
no, go ahead.
He somehow,
yes, there has been a couple of
burrowed
those.
His way into my life, mm-hmm. which I'm very happy to have. Someone told me a long time ago, you should have three types of professional relationships: a mentor, an equal, and someone that you can mentor.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to mentor him, but he got a call, an email from A24, the distributor, and said he had applied for this internship without telling his parents. And they asked him if he could come in for an interview. And he got in his car in Indiana without telling his parents and drove.
That is awesome.
Last night, through the night.
It's kind of awesome, though.
It is kind of awesome. He just texted me. He got an email asking, a follow-up email asking him if he could
come. That shows such, no pun intended, but drive.
Yes. He got a...
Can we get him on the phone and have him on the podcast?
He got an email back this morning asking if he could come in on Monday. But I think he's already halfway back to Indiana.
Why?
I don't know. He wanted to go home. He wanted to go see the Statue of Liberty, and then he wanted to go home.
So he made it here, and then he got the email saying it's postponed.
No. He got through the first round. He got another email trying to come back.
Oh.
And he's already on his way back to Indiana.
Well, that seems like they could possibly... Well, they could be... I would imagine if I was running A24 or one of the people, and I had this arrangement, I would say, he's a young guy, we can do it over the phone or on FaceTime or something.
I don't think
like
they
that.
Realized he was in Indiana.
I think they should know because how ambitious he is and how driven he is. I mean, that speaks
it's
volumes.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It really is
so
a great
last
story.
Last night I took him out to the bar and he had his first beer ever in New York. He's never been to New York before.
That's fantastic. You're a mensch.
Anyways.
That's great. And you're also condoning, technically you're a kidnapper.
Yes.
I think that's you've committed federal crimes.
Yeah. Don't tell his parents.
No.
His parents are listening. I'm sure they're Filmworks listeners, but
we haven't even dropped his name, and nor will we.
No.
And it's probably a guy, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm glad his car was reliable.
I think he may have gotten a rental. I don't know.
That's even more crazy. Wait, how old is he?
He's 21.
Oh, okay. So he's wait a minute. What was he? 21. What does he need 21. Anybody's permission to drive across wherever he wants
lives
to go?
With his parents. It's
so
in
what?
Indiana. He's very conservative.
All right, but it doesn't. But there's no. There's not even an issue. Well, he's 21.
They don't.
I may leave that edited out of the show because it sounded better.
Right. They don't support his filmmaking.
I understand.
Yeah.
All that, and right. I understand his decision.
So he had to hide
okay,
it from.
Okay. I understand why he hid it, and it was a right choice.
Right.
But even if it's still not their business. Technically, he can choose whatever he wants to do as an adult.
Let's get him on the phone.
He can do everything. Let's get him on the phone. Fine. No. I'm happy to. If you want to put him on the spot. I'm happy to do it. Indiana's own. And he can still remain anonymous for all I care.
He did a lot of
get
work
on
the film. Very, very nice guy. You'll probably be hearing from him in like 3 years when he has a film that's out
yeah.
and about.
But it's interesting. I was just thinking similarly, like 2 years ago, right before South by Southwest, and everybody who listens regularly to this podcast knows this anecdote. It's one of like, I have like three or four anecdotes I don't ever stop telling over and over every chance I get. And that is...
Have
right
we started yet?
Days, yeah, oh yeah. Days before Andrew Cohen, director of Night School, opening June 9th in select cities, distributed by Oscilloscope Laboratories. Days before, like South by Southwest, 2015. I got an email, and I get a lot of these, like once, like two or three a week. So when I say a lot, it's. You know,
And they're usually like, I invite this, by the way, on the show. I'll say, please let me know what you're thinking, if you have ideas, write them in. And people do. They write in, I think I would be a great guest on your show. Please watch my film. Do you have any feedback? I'd appreciate, I get that a lot. And so right before South by Southwest a couple years ago, I got an email, and since I was preparing for that trip, I kind of was going to ignore it. At the very last second, I decided to, okay, let me see what this guy, and it was some guy named Trey Schultz.
Wow.
And he said, he knew I was going because he listened to my podcast. He said, since you're coming to, maybe you can find time to come see my premiere. I'm like, well, I really don't know if I have any time.
That happened to me with Leah Dunham. Tiny Furniture.
Come on.
She was like, could you please, because I was working for Found Magazine at the time with Davey.
Oh.
And she loved Found.
Oh, okay.
And she was, could you guys please maybe come to the premiere? We're having an after party.
You're rolling your eyes. Yeah. She was so, not that I know if she's not different, but she, is a multimillionaire mogul. But I sat with her right as Tiny Furniture came out. Not for the podcast. I wasn't doing the podcast, but I audio recorded it for transcribing. And we met at the offices of NPR because she had just done some NPR show, Low Paid, or one of the shows to promote Tiny Furniture. And I was asked to meet her there. And I hadn't kind of heard of her. And I liked the film, but I had no other context. The reason I went to see is because I know Alex Karpovsky really right. well. He'd been on the show many times before Tiny Furniture came out. So I sat with her too. And it was really, she was so sweet. She was so lovely and very available, very accessible, just great. So I'm thinking I could never post it because, it wasn't for audio podcasting. So,
right.
I never felt like but I do have that conversation.
Probably worth something.
Okay. Well, I wish your mentoree all the luck in the world.
Is it mentee?
No, there's a separate word for you're the mentor. They are the, student, but maybe not the student. There's
mentee,
another word.
Mentoree.
Mentoree, or there's another word for it. I'm pretty sure I'm forgetting what it is. Okay, well, I'm glad that our paths are crossing again, Andrew, because, first of all, I like having you back on.
Thank you. It's nice
to have people like yourself, very nice, talented, friendly filmmakers come back over and over.
Two out of three, yeah.
And then on top of it, this is a great film, it turns out. So that was nice.
Yeah.
I was watching it ho-hum. No, I was prepared to enjoy it. I had a feeling I knew what you were going to be going for, and you deliver.
There's nothing better than when you meet someone and you really, really like them, mm-hmm. and then you watch their movie and it's really good.
Yeah, that is
me. You know what I mean?
It's much easier to have those otherwise not, awkward conversations.
Yeah, I think I'd rather be liked and have my movies suck than be an asshole and make great movies.
That's hard because I know a few of those for sure in the business, and
at least that you can control being nice. Sometimes
those people have been on the show once.
Right. But I appreciate that. And we see each other a lot at events. And
that's right.
The documentary community here is incredible. I just relocated to Los Angeles. And it's one of the things that I miss most, actually.
Is that fraternity or just how you can run into people over and that it's very easy to go to things. You don't have to plan so far and get in the car.
Yeah,
and then you
run into people at bars
all the time,
coffee all the time.
Right.
And people are really supportive and
help each other out.
Help each other out and encourage each other and also challenge each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to lie here and say it's not competitive.
I dare you to make this film good.
Right. Well, you and your neighbors with Zach Heinzeling and your roommates with, Latfi Nathan, you want to make good movies.
Both Oscilloscope filmmakers, right?
I think
Drafthouse. I don't think that's true. We're going to argue.
Well,
first person to call in that would be it would turn out to be your intern. I'm sorry, your mentoree. I don't think it was that. But then a part of me wants to. I did so much stuff with that film. I should. The fact that I'm blanking is embarrassing on it, but I'm pretty sure it's not Draft House.
I when I was making Night School, I was teaching at the university there at Purdue.
Oh.
So once a week I would drive up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the first movie I showed, I did a documentary class.
Mm-hmm.
The first movie I showed was Cutie and the Boxer.
It was so good.
To show something that was contemporary, that were kind of breaking the mold for what I think that, if you're 19 years old and you grew up in Indiana, you probably haven't seen a movie like that before,
mm-hmm.
And so that was the first movie I showed, and Zach came and Skyped in and talked to the class. That was nice too, of one of the nice things about being here is just the access you have to friends, you know, for stuff like that. You know,
you could put together things and people will be able to come because it's New York. You know, it's like I have there's this other part of it, which is, let's say you are in L.A., but let's say I want to have you back on the show. I'm like, well, eventually you'll be flying through or to New York, and it's only a matter of being a little patient, but everybody comes through New York eventually if they're working in this business, you know.
Or just find me at Midway Bar in Williamsburg.
Okay, where's that one?
It's on South 2nd and Driggs.
Oh, okay.
We're getting off topic.
Anyways. A little bit. Let's talk about night school. I'll begin describing it. It takes place in Indianapolis, a city which has, a real history or issue with high school dropout rates, and it's also among its more impoverished population or underserved population. And an opportunity is available all of a sudden where there's a new school. It's new?
It's a charter school.
Adults.
Yes, for adults.
Who have not finished. Again, this is not to get a GED for those listening. This is actually to get their high school degree. They have to finish classes, all the classwork they didn't finish when they were 15 through 18, whatever.
Yes, and they've all dropped out at different points in their life. So some have more credits than others.
Right.
There's also a component where they have to get a trade certified in a technical trade, mm-hmm. Which isn't very prevalent in the prevalent in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a school that's really doing amazing work for a large group of people that have pretty much just been neglected.
Right. Those things come across also in this film, their struggle, even though the film primarily follows three individuals named Greg, Melissa, and Shanika, we see others as well, sort of supporting characters, if you want to call them that. And what we witness is how a very non-judgmental film, thank you, by the way, that's nice, but also just like how vulnerable and delicate these people's lives are in terms of all of those sharks right there in the water. You know, it's like they are so vulnerable to, it's like they're all set up for failure.
Yeah, I think audience,
dropouting and dropping out too.
Yeah, and I think audiences, you know, really have hopefully seen just how intertwined all this stuff is.
Yeah.
You know, in inner city, it's transportation, it's health, it's everything that you
every
mentioned.
Every step of the way.
It's poverty. And so it's all these things kind of mounting up together.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the reasons people get so frustrated and want to throw up their hands is because there's no one-stop shop to fixing the problem. You know, and so one of the things when I was making the film and I lived in the neighborhood for 8 months.
Right, you embedded yourself.
Yeah. Embedded myself, and it was very...
With your cinematographer, we
should add. Yes, very sticky situations and sometimes. I actually had someone come into my house with a gun and robbed us.
Mm-hmm.
But you just get this overall sense of...
Survival. Leave the film equipment.
Yeah, of just leave desperation the and anxiety and all these things that you, unless you've really lived in the inner city for a long extended period of time. And look, I get to go back to Brooklyn. I'm not putting myself, I would never try to claim that I've spent a lot of time in the inner city.
Right.
But there is this overall just stress and frustration and anger, you know, that you can't understand until you've lived there for a really long time. And it's just so frustrating. And you just want to, you know, reach out to these people and, you know, for me, give them a voice.
It's interesting because when you're passing by in Park Slope, the senior group that is protesting no elevator at the 7th Avenue stop, you know, they should be able to do that, but try going to some other neighborhoods where the idea of protesting for an elevator is kind of I'm getting off topic again, but there is a striking contrast. But having said that, there's a lot of humanity in this, and you really root for these guys. I mean, I'm not sure how you did it, and I'm going to be very cautious.
Sure.
How I talk about their stories because we don't want to give away too much either, because, you know, of course, the ending is a graduation are these three subjects who by the end of this 80 minutes or so are rooting for and feel somewhat attached to, are they going to graduate? Are they going to be able to overcome all the obstacles that are in their way of graduating? You know, and it's really, really greatly edited and paced and all that.
You know, the editor is actually the speaking of Latvia, we did 12 O'Clock Boys.
Oh, which was set in Baltimore.
Yeah, which was set in Baltimore, and a great editor, named Thomas Niles.
Okay.
And just a really, really great guy to work with. And he and I, you know, we talked about all these things beforehand, mm-hmm. you know, the tone. Because being white and making a movie about the inner city experience, it was the first thing I thought about every day when I woke up. You know, is how does my own perceptions and ideas filter out into my digesting this experience, and mm-hmm. how am I going to recreate or consolidate this entire 8 months into 83 minutes into a version of the truth that is representative of their experience, not mine. And so that was a challenge, and there were a lot of things that I thought about in the edit with Thomas, you know, and when we were filming and choosing the subjects of how to walk that line.
Mm-hmm. What was the reaction you already said that you might not have been as welcome in the neighborhood initially anyway. I don't know when this break-in took place.
Yeah, Greg, I mean, Greg thought one of the subjects of the film thought I was a cop for like 2 months.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wasn't it to where
I think
on
in the
stage
notes you describe at Tribeca. When you would show up with him, his friends would always say, who's the cop you're hanging out with?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was and Melissa, she has you know, quite a personality. I was just so intimidated by her, you know. And so it was I think the only way that you can make a film like that and really get those authentic moments is to really embed yourself in that community.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I just don't think that you can go and be there for 2-3 weeks and then leave and understand and earn the trust.
Right.
You know, to be able to be there for those very vulnerable moments. I mean, I think that when it comes to documentary filmmaking, you know, people in general are pretty smart, and they know the reasons you're there, and they can sniff and know when you're being genuine.
Mm.
And if you are being genuine, people want to tell their story. People generally want to understand, you know, the world around them and tell their own experience. And so, you know, my goal when I'm making a film is to... not even just as a filmmaker. If I didn't have a camera, I'd be talking to these people. I'm the guy that talks to the waiter for 5 hours, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's just... and I learned that a lot from Davey Rothbart, who I directed Medora with, who's mm-hmm. a great journalist and has done a lot of great work with NPR and This American Life.
Yeah, let's do a shout-out for the show. And I know you still have a relationship with the magazine. I'm not sure. You don't have anything to do with their podcast, though, right?
No.
But Davey's the host of Found, which is a very popular podcast. If he keeps at it, he may get, you know, the kind of audience that Film Wax Radio gets, but I'm not going to tell him.
Let's not tell him how to do his job, but, you know. And
I am surprised he probably feels a little bit intimidated, is probably why he hasn't reached out to me.
Yeah.
So I guess.
Either jealousy.
Jealousy is probably entering into it. Bigger. I get that a lot. Yeah. A lot of people don't reach out to me. So that's what that must be about.
But he was very early on to explain to me the importance of you know, listening. You know, and how important that is. And I think that, you know, a lot of filmmakers, they so badly want to get their point across. And a lot of them are for good reasons. You know, a lot of them are I remember I did an interview of a few months ago, and I said I hated social issue documentaries. I really caught a lot of flack for that. And I didn't mean that I hate social issue documentaries. I sometimes hate the approach that social issue documentary filmmakers make, where they're using subjects to get a point across, and even though that point may be valid, it may be very
important,
you know,
correct.
Yes, but I don't like one-dimensional characters. You know, I don't like things that just serve a plot or serve a point. And so, when I went in to start making the film, I didn't look for subjects that were getting the record expunged or dealing with the law or anything or a single father. There was nothing that I was really trying to accomplish.
It's easy to be polemical, you know?
Yeah.
And it's easy to lean on that.
Right.
I just had on Amir Barlev, and that was, what a great filmmaker. And I don't know how it came, I don't know how he hadn't been on before. I just had him on for a Long Strange Trip, which is, you know, this Grateful Dead documentary. I mean, but you think about the films he has, and he said pretty much the same. He goes, you know, he doesn't want any talking heads. I mean, that aren't actively involved. I said, why didn't you, you know, when I'm watching The Long Strange Trip, I kept expecting, you know, like Dylan and...
Or an expert or a...
Tom Petty. Right. The usual suspects that always remark on. And he goes, I just don't want... I said, well, with Dylan, you could have, because they certainly collaborated enough, and they certainly covered enough of his song. He said, yeah, but then it would have just taken you out of the what he was trying to do. You know, and he only wants to populate his film with people that were actively part of the story, not bring in outsiders for that.
Right. I mean, I think it goes back to, like, the documentary form is on the rise, and there's more and more documentaries every day
than ever.
And there's going to be more. And so you're starting to get subsets and different...
Subgenres and all.
Subgenres and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, the films that I love making, the films that I love watching are intimate films, you know, that are about regular, everyday people. Right, Cutie and the Boxer that we talked about before, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. That may not have huge critical success, you know, or box office, but they're the films that I'm attracted to. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's one of the challenges, I think, for a lot of filmmakers is, what if you don't want to make rock and roll documentaries? What if you don't want to do political documentaries? You know, and so... I think that there's something, like, for me, I go to the movies because I want to feel something.
Yeah, me
not
too.
Not because I want information. And God bless, you know, the 13th or whatever, but that could have been an Atlantic article. You know, I love the film.
No, we're not
I think
here
it's
to
important.
Put down Ava DuVernay because we want her on the show. No, okay.
I love her work, and I think it's really important. I'm talking about the films that I love and the films that I want to make.
Yes.
You know,
I agree. And I want to just say, since we're talking about the emotional response to a film, this one is, you know, had you put one expert in this film, just one little comment by one expert, well, it would have been odd, but it would also have, it would just have broken the whole feel.
To have a guy come and talk about higher education, or dropout rates,
or the psychologist who sociologist who talks about how broken things are, and you know, So therefore, like by the end, you are so caught up and I was very moved by the end either, and your little epilogue was nice little.
I love epilogues.
Gift.
I'm such a sucker for epilogues. Everybody wants to know where they are now.
A lot of documentaries are doing this device. I was talking to another filmmaker maybe, but it was like how you started. I just watched it today with Nowhere to Hide. You know, that's at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. You know, with this little bit of a few seconds, and then it goes 3 months earlier.
Right.
It's like a lot of documentaries start off in the present and then work backward. And, the epilogue is...
It's such an exciting time for docs right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just blown away by the stuff
that I'm
seeing.
Well, there's an audience for it.
There's an audience for it, and the filmmakers have really stepped up to the opening.
Yeah.
Have taken advantage of this space. It's just so inspiring to see the work that other people are doing. And I truly mean that. I'm in awe when I sit down and watch a movie like Rat Film. You know, Theo Anthony's movie.
Who's coming up on the show.
This guy's 25 years old.
Yeah, it's
you
punk.
Know, and I'm just so happy that I watched a rough cut of this kid, Bing. He's 23. He made a film about three skateboarders outside of Chicago in this little town in Illinois.
Yeah,
beautiful film.
Right,
Verite. Not
Medora,
a single talking.
Does that take place in Illinois?
Indiana.
Yeah. Excuse me. Both.
Which just you can see that they've digested the work before them, mm-hmm. that they've done their homework, that they're listening and paying attention. You know, and that. They're finding their own voice in a way, in a medium that is so accessible right now. You know, cameras, editing equipment. I was, you know, telling the kid, you know, my student, he said, what would you say? You know, I want to be a filmmaker. Where should I? I said, go make a movie.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that easy, you know, with documentary.
Watch a lot of them, too.
Watch a lot of them.
Because you can start to, it gets into your fiber, storytelling.
Right.
You can go to a class and expedite it because a class could actually tell you, these are structures that are available to you that seem to have a successful track record. Or you can watch hundreds of hours of films and kind of get an inherent sense of that structure as well. You can take what you like, what affects you, you know. So I always recommend also just seeing a lot of films.
And a lot of kids have a great grip of the technical side.
Uh-huh.
I think that's one of the downfalls of the technology being so cheap.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of these kids are making stuff that looks great, you know, but I think some of them lack the storytelling, storytelling kind of these things that were beat into me when I was, you know, a creative writing major, you know.
Yeah. And you develop a sense about the commercial and financial imperatives. I'm not saying you make a film that's going to be for popular consumption or will be, you know, whatever, but you do think about how people watch your film and how and all the other kinds of things that swirl around any film. You know, what do I want that to look like? And, you know, there's you have a multidimensional approach to something the older you get and the more experience you get, which any young person, unless they're brilliant, and there are some certainly kids that are that way, that get it so early, you know, they can just come up with their first film is just really sophisticated, you know, and they just get it. But yeah. Most people have to develop it.
Yeah, for sure. But I think that right now there's no shortage of just people out there making great work. You know, and it's just inspiring, you know, right. And I just, you know, hopefully try and keep up.
Mm-hmm. I've seen another little just group of great documentaries recently.
They're all.
I just saw the one yesterday at Cinema Fest, a press screening. Dina.
Okay.
Which has a lot of pedigree. It's like, you know, the producers are all these really seasoned filmmakers, but it's just just another really. Terrific bit of filmmaking.
One thing I worry about is whether we're living in a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing that I constantly question. And the films that I make, I want them not purposely. I think my instincts are to make stuff that can reach a wide audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as documentary filmmakers, we need to be conscious of the fact that we can't keep making documentaries for ourselves and for our own bubble and our own audience. That at a certain point, who are you making this movie for and who are you trying to convince? So I think that a challenge for documentary filmmakers is to understand, to try and reach wider, different audiences, if that makes any sense.
Well, I mean, so you're talking about the bubble isn't necessarily just filmmakers in this world, but also...
New York and LA.
Okay. But I was thinking also you meant you're making it for people that are essentially
like-minded.
Think like you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So
exactly. And I think that's one of the challenges is how do you get outside and make documentary films outside of the liberal bubble? Because if you want the art form to grow and keep expanding, I think that you wanted. Yes, I love challenging material.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you need to be able to challenge audiences too, mm-hmm. you know, and so... That's one of the things I think about all the time when I'm thinking about documentary.
It's good to think about it because I don't know whether or not you can break through that or not, at least even just thinking about it. Because, you know, one little subpopulation I think is great. I love when I meet the suburban middle-aged woman or guy and they're just, I love documentaries.
It's like the biggest murder.
I
love it.
Or just when you meet somebody who,
I know,
like, you know, they come to a film because their son or their son's friend made or some nephew, and they come in from from wherever they live, and they come into the city, and they come and they're very excited and they're very encouraging and supportive, and then and you start and you meet them. And they're just like, I love documentary. I think as though they discovered this type of film that they want to share.
Well, if you live
really?
In New York
so
and LA,
where do you find these documentaries?
Right. Well, if you live in New York and LA, you have access to all these films
and
culture. But if you live in,
they're shooting them on your block often. You know,
right? But you know, if you live in Middle America, you're
and Middle America is only a few miles from any city.
Right. And you're living, you're on Netflix and you're looking for stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
well, good luck on Netflix, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
You know, other than what they're now stamping as original films, and there are some, like, I know that they've had a few recent ones, the one on, what's the guy, the political...
the Roger Stone
documentary, which was pretty... well, I don't feel like I should use this to trash a film. I thought it was poorly edited, but I do. I think it was poorly edited.
I have problems with
it.
Yeah,
it was
stuff
still
like
entertaining because the subject could just do anything and he's really entertaining.
Yes, but at the same point, aren't you kind of
me.
Giving a mouthpiece to something that doesn't deserve it? I understand that, I'm just going to put it out there and let other people decide whether they like him and the dude's a sociopath and whatever. But you're still giving him a microphone.
Mm-hmm. Did you see Casting JonBenet?
I did.
Uh-huh. Another Netflix version.
Yeah, I think that there's some really interesting stuff going on, with blending, questioning truth and questioning.
Mm-hmm.
I typically go to documentaries because I want to get closer to the truth, not question my relationship to it. So I'm not sure. I think this trend's been going a long time. It's been going on in Europe before us, and you're seeing people like Robert Greene, who's really pushing that.
Yeah,
and I think
Kate plays Christine, which I thought was successful at doing what these guys were trying to do. And
yes.
You could say, those two, that came to mind when I was watching I started making JonBenet at casting JonBenet at Montclair, actually.
What's your take on that sort of perspective on doc filmmaking? Do you think it'll have lasting power, intentionally
trying to make hybrid types of films,
not just hybrid, but having the audience questioning, you know,
the veracity of the
of the
story,
or just questioning truth in general and how we perceive the truth.
I don't know. I'm a little bit more maybe conventional in that way. So,
yeah.
But I think you can do it artfully, and then just, you know, think about. In that case, I just thought Christine,
the actress.
No. I know Kate right. very well, but she. But no, the newscaster.
Right.
Christine. Anyway, she shot herself on TV, so it was very, very specific what she did. You know, in a way. And she was commenting through her final act on, what was it? If it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
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 So it's really, I don't know, it was very, very surreal in a way. I acted, you know what I mean? So it was a political act.
Right. It's interesting. I think that sometimes when I watch films like that, I think it's important to push the genre. I think that it may not land with everyone, and there's going to be mistakes when you're really pushing the boundaries.
But I
do think that oftentimes people will use that as a narrative device instead of actually challenging an audience, that they're using that as edit this out, never mind.
I know, but I do appreciate some of this. And I felt actually that in the case of Casting Judgment, just to wrap that up, is that in fact it was closer to another documentary, which was totally the opposite side, when I talked to the filmmakers about their film, which was called Newtown, which was just dodged the bullet of being polemical. But to their credit, they dwelled on the kind of the resiliency of this community in Connecticut, and how they bound. I shouldn't say they rebound, but how they survived and moved on in a way, and took the most horrific tragedy one could ever imagine, and in a way tried to find some good out of it.
Yeah.
And the filmmakers honored that really well. And it was focusing on the community and their stories that spoke, you know, to me. And I and likewise in casting JonBenet, I think, you know, those people that were being cast as Patsy and John were from the community, and they and I was hoping that would have been a little bit more effective, like those that I would have gotten a little. I think that's what they were trying to achieve, and there was also like they're coming out of that and trying to move on, that they were more than that event, and that they could move on from that because they all had connections to that family, you know, in some manner. So in that regard, I found those two documentaries interesting to pair. You know?
Right. Yeah, there's a whole...
But you're right. Well, you can only do that now because there's just so many documentaries and they're so interesting, and there's, you know, everybody's getting a documentary.
Yeah.
You know, well, and every subject
name,
and every...
The word documentary seems to be changing almost by the minute.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's great.
Nonfiction.
Right. I think that's great. And I think that, you know, we should support people that are pushing boundaries and taking chances.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to lose sight of Night School. Where is this? I should see where it's. Oh, it premiered at Tribeca Film Festival last year. Got picked up by Oscilloscope in a heated bidding war. I heard
really down to the wire. You know,
you happy with Oscilloscope?
Yeah, they've been great. And I'm some of my favorite docs have been on Oscilloscope. So they're
right.
They're
you mentioned 12 o'clock Boys. And...
Yeah. I think that they understand, you know, documentaries and how to market them.
Right.
In a way that's really interesting and really fun.
Right. Everybody's going to be able to relate to these three people in this. And I'm just going to assume that all three of your subjects loved the film and really appreciated how they were portrayed in it. Because you gave them as much humanity as they gave you. And I think that was so...
Yeah. I think that... You know, when I'm making a film, I'm looking for great characters, great stories, all that stuff wrapped up.
Well, let me also read something from your statement, which maybe will help.
I don't remember writing this.
Okay, well, maybe you didn't. Sydney writes for you in your voice. It says here, when looking for your subjects, because I found this interesting, what you said, how you approached, because you know, there were like some, initially going into that school year, there were like 300 people, which necessarily got whittled down just because of redropping out.
Right.
And we say that, you know, only because it's so stressful with some of the, I mean, trying to make it work, like, with the best of all intentions. And some people, I'm sure, tried again and, you know, hopefully got
the door is always open.
That's great.
To come in or
leave. Because, yeah, how you chose your three subjects, it was, the words you used sounded like how you choose friends. I mean, okay, here it is, I think. One is, are they really interesting? Am I engaged talking to them? Would I want to hang out with them? Another thing is, do they really have an interesting story? I mean, isn't that how we kind of pick friends too?
Yes.
Is there any difference really in terms of you're attracted to them?
One thing I realized very early on in my filmmaking is that I never want to make a documentary about someone that I don't like. Life is too short to be surrounded and stuck in.
No Roger Stone documentaries coming from
Andrew. I would find that so frustrating and toxic to use your platform, even if you hate someone, to put out something like that, even if they deserve it, you know. But I don't know. I like making films about people living on the fringes of society.
Yeah,
I love making films about people in the Midwest. I love making films about people that would otherwise not have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
I love making films about people who are utterly shocked that you are interested in their life. Melissa said that a lot. Why are you filming me? Yeah. Why do you think this is interesting? And there's an earnestness to the people in the Midwest that I love. That they are so matter of fact, and you get such real, genuine emotion out of them that they're not. First of all, their expectations are extremely low.
The bar is low.
I remember them watching the documentary, and Greg, one of the subjects of the film, said, "Man, that was way better than I thought it was going to be."
Well, they're probably thinking, "What does he think he's getting?" Like. You know, they understand emotional storytelling, ultimately.
But not only that, most of them never watched a documentary.
Sure.
They've maybe seen ESPN 30 for 30, but they
And then, right, there's so much reality television
Right,
out
but
there.
I don't think that they have any preconceived notion of what they're participating in.
Right.
And so I think that that's when you can get some really great stuff.
Absolutely.
You know? Keep those expectation levels low, filmmakers.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, hang out with them like they're your buddies. You know, I mean, that's people say, oh, is there a line that you draw, you know, between your filmmaker and subject? I walk all over that line. I give them rides. I hang out with them without the cameras on. You know, a film like this relies on intimacy and access. It's not a political film. There's not some big reveal at the end. It's really a film where you're living in people's shoes. And so to be able to get that access and be able to get those moments, you have to spend a lot of time. You got to do all the things that we talked about. But
especially in that environment, I can understand. I mean, even Frederick Wiseman, who's done my podcast, said twice, maybe three times. I sat with him several times.
Lost count.
Well, I did, because one time it was also not for the podcast, twice for the podcast, and then once I did a Q&A where he Skyped in from, you know, Boston or something, or wherever he was. And it was really funny because he spent the first 10 minutes of the Q&A. We had showed high school, perhaps, and I did the Q&A with him. It was the same weekend.
Quite a few times for this.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that makes sense.
Of course. You got to watch high school.
Glad I'm connecting all the dots.
I was actually offered a job on his new movie, which I turned down.
That's crazy. Why would you do that? To work with the...
Because I want to come do this podcast.
Oh, you mean literally just now. Well, you can come back on. I'm trying to get him for the long conversation, you know.
Yeah.
But he said, Frederick Wiseman said that, you know, how do you get through to the point where people aren't really, self-conscious? What he goes, well, initially, if they're interested, he doesn't have the same approach you do because he's doing something different. But, you know, it's like, let them touch the camera. Let them look through the camera if that's what they want. You know, the sooner that phase of the... whatever you want to call it, newness and the oddity of it is past, the sooner you can get on to being invisible again.
And I'm very frank. If people have questions, I'm happy to, you know. So how's this going to work? Oh, well, maybe I'll use some of this interview and I'll do some shots of you. Well, what are you doing right now? And I answer questions. It's not like I'm, you know, behind the curtain. I don't want anyone to know what's going on.
Yeah, right.
I think the more that you're
transparent.
Not only that, but your subjects are your partners. And that's the one thing that I try to tell my students is that you can't have someone in your movie mm-hmm. that relies on access that's fighting you
right.
and doesn't want to be on camera and doesn't want to fully participate. And so every person that's been in any one of my films, at every single one, at some point I had to have a conversation with and say, do you want to do this or not? Mm-hmm. Because you're dodging my calls. You don't want to do this. You're letting me film some stuff and not other stuff.
Right.
And so I say, look, first of all, I totally understand I would never want to be in a documentary. And so I totally understand if you don't want to do this. But if mm-hmm. you want to do this, you have to give me 100% access. And I have had that conversation with everyone that's been in my film that served at one point. And it's nice when you've done a couple films that you can give them a DVD and say, this is kind of what it's going to be like.
Yeah.
So they can play. So they can play. They're playing along. Whether you want to believe it or not, everybody knows that when you put a camera on someone, their behavior changes. If I pulled out my iPhone right now and pointed it towards you, you probably cringe and go, you know, you're startled. And it's,
right.
And so don't avoid that. Don't pretend it doesn't exist and say, oh, this is just going to be totally natural. And
right.
There's always a sense of performance, I think, from people, and you chip away at it and chip away at it and edit around it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one thing I realized early on was a lot of stuff that I shot, you know, I shot 700 hours of footage, the stuff that I thought was amazing.
Yeah.
I got back in the editing room, I'm like, that's it?
Yeah.
I remember it so much more vividly, and it was so bold and amazing. Right. And then some of the footage that I thought was totally boring.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's a great scene.
Yeah,
and until you get back in the edit and you start putting it in the context and understand your story
right.
fully, can you really don't judge the footage?
It may be that edit. You know, just that sigh at that particular moment.
A moment, right? A pause.
These sort of seemingly mundane moments, but that speak volumes. Maybe is it God in the details or is it the devil in the details? I'm not sure.
Right.
But Night School has a lot of great details. So see it. It will be playing certainly here in New York City on June 9th for a theatrical. Where else?
We're doing IFC on the 9th. We're doing Indianapolis on the 23rd.
Of course, Indianapolis.
We're doing the Lemley in Los Angeles.
Where are you going to be on the opening night? Can you say?
On the 9th?
Yeah.
Where am I going to be?
Yeah, which town? There's three.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, where are you going to be in terms of your doing? What Q&A are you going to
be? I will
be
in New York at the IFC Center.
Oh, you will be here.
Yes. Okay. I'll be the guy in the back row with a Modelo.
Okay. Are you going to Indianapolis on Saturday?
Indianapolis, going to hang out with the subject of the film.
Right.
They're going to get to see the movie on the big screen again. They've done some festivals.
And do some Q&As.
Q&As.
Of course.
I think we're doing a screening in Detroit, which is my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll take it to Los Angeles, and it'll hit iTunes, Netflix, all that stuff.
Sounds good.
I'm excited. I just want I hope that we can find people to support small, intimate documentaries. You know?
Yeah.
Because I love to support films like this. So I hope people come out and enjoy it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was good being here. Next time, I'll try and bring more pizza.
Thanks. A shout out to. Do we know the name of that place?
No, the pizza shop downtown.
In Industry City, it's one of the best pizza places. It's $4 a slice. I'm going to just tell you right there, at least that's just for
it's
a plain slice.
Sponsor of this,
but
podcast.
I'm trying to. Yeah, it would be great to get some more. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you.
Every man comes to a point in their life when they have to take a stand by themselves.
Hallelujah!
And you gonna take me out here, man, because I don't know if my brother gonna make it or not, man.
So you should be very proud.
Oh my God. This is what
we don't want minimum wages. We want living wages.
I done been through hell and hot water to get here, for mm-hmm. real.
I want to say that I did something with myself, with my life.
Once again, the Human Rights Watch Film Festival New York City edition will be taking place in New York at the IFC Center and at the Film Society of Lincoln Center from the 9th of June through the 18th. And I already have to tell you that I've seen quite a few of the films, including Bill Nye, Science Guy, from filmmakers David Alvarado and Jason Susberg. I've seen Lindy Lou, Juror No. 2 by Florent Vasseau.
I have seen Nobody Speak, The Trials of the Free Press by Brian Knappenberger, who's going to be coming onto the podcast to discuss that film, actually. I've seen The Force, directed by Peter Nix. Wonderful documentary. I hope to be bringing Peter on as well. And then, and I highly recommend also the documentary Nowhere to Hide, which is by Zardasht Ahmed, which I also got a chance to see. So I saw quite a few of the documentaries that are playing in the festival, so I'm going to recommend it. So here is my conversation with the senior programmer of the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, Ms. Leah Siegman.
Good music happening. Is that
good?
It's
the Grateful Dead, isn't it? Is that what we're hearing in the background here?
I am like very embarrassed to admit I don't know the Grateful Dead at all.
That's so un-American of you.
I know. I should go watch that film that I...
Amir Bartlett?
Could paint that. Yeah, Amir.
Amir. He was on my last episode.
I listened to some of
it. You
did? Oh, yeah,
thank you.
I love him. We used to work in the same offices, actually.
Oh, wow. Leah Siegman.
What's that?
I was just introducing you.
Leah Siegman.
Yeah. Is there another part to your name?
No, it's a short and sweet. Short and
it
sweet.
Is. Unlike you, by the way, who sweet, yes, but you're not short. See, editing already. Who knew? Who
thought? The self-edit is really
no,
important.
You're tall. So let's just set the scene a little bit, too. First of all, Leah, who we've known each other for a number of years, ran into you a few times at Tribeca, right? I'm sorry. I can hear myself so well. Do you want to hear yourself, by the way?
I don't know what's easy. I have headphones.
You do? Oh, I can make this happen. All right, so let's start from the top-ish kind of. I used to run into you, I guess, at Tribeca.
Yes.
Right?
I think even before that.
I think so, too.
Yeah, I've kind of done the rounds at different independent media places and Tribeca for a minute.
Where were you there before that?
I was at POV, Brooklyn
POV.
Film Festival, Arts Engine.
You really have?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's been a while. It's been like 10 years of it, so...
Have you lived here all the time?
Yeah, I've been here 17 years now.
You have? Yeah. Why do you even have a trace of an accent? Can you turn it off?
If I go to Manchester, I have an American accent. Well, no, maybe not, but a twang.
You're from Manchester.
I am from Manchester.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, there's a whole can of worms right there, right?
Well,
not talk about that. I don't know.
The world over is kind of messed up right now.
It's very true.
Terrible things happening in every corner. So
it's
not the greatest thing to be known for right now. But
it's true.
It was football and good music, and now it's kind of horrible
association.
Association.
But did you get a lot of those Facebook, I'm safe?
You know, they didn't do that in the same way as I've seen done in... other cities. There wasn't that kind
of
formal.
There, right?
Yeah, of course. And my parents are still there. But it was a bit more, you know, obviously a lot of expressions of concern and sadness. And but there was a lot of solidarity. There's a lot of pride in Manchester about being from a city that's got its own reputation. And
it's so worldwide famous for soccer.
Yep. And the Smiths
and
Stone Roses, you know. Good music back in the day, and but also there's it's a really international working class city, so
I've been there.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah,
no one goes to Manchester.
I was in Mercy because I have a friend, my friend Nigel Jones. I mean, could he have
a very
more
English
Jewish name.
Name
than that?
It's a
anyway,
such an English name.
It is.
It's Nigel.
It's a bit too English. And is No, they were in Merseyside. It was like
Merseyside. Yeah, that's a little more Liverpool-y.
Yeah, it's like in between. But
yeah.
I recall taking maybe I took a train to Liverpool and then from there hopped over to Merseyside. But because I was in that general area, I made my way over to Manchester at some point or other.
Yeah, it's a fun city.
Yeah.
It's good people. Good people.
It's true.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for appearing on the show. And
it's been real.
So it's surreal. Anyway, no, Leah, what's your official title?
I'm the senior programmer.
Senior programmer.
And also the film festival manager for New York edition.
Oh, right.
Because we have multiple
that's right.
editions. Yeah.
Well, we're talking about the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, first of all. They do occur in different cities around the world, right?
Yes.
How many?
This is one of the things you were looking at. It varies year to year. It's around 15 to 20 right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's
and they're very different in format, though. London and New York being our biggest, around 20 films, 16 to 20 films right. per year. But we also have one-off screenings in Geneva or a mm-hmm. five-day festival in Nairobi. So they kind of span North America and Europe for the most part.
Yeah.
And we also partner throughout the year with different film festivals where we co-present a number of films.
And how long have you been with the Human Rights Watch?
Around 3 years.
Okay.
Maybe a little longer. Yeah, right. 3 years sounds about right.
Yeah, because it was about that. I guess then it was right before then that I had John Biagi on.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it was, this is maybe now, that was, let's say if that was my first festival that I was covering, this would be the fourth of that.
Right.
So that's why I didn't interact with you before.
Yes, that would make sense.
Year.
That would make
but
sense.
But if I had known, I should have been, we should be doing this every year.
Yeah, no, we've got some good films every year.
It is true. And, you know, this year, like, I mean, I'm not going to say especially, but it's, let me also just say one thing. If you're hearing a lot of background noise, usually that's, happens when I go to a festival because it's hard to find always, you know, quiet places. Mm-hmm. Plus it gives you the vibe. But we're actually at a place called 420 Blackbirds, which is a pie shop here in Gowanus. And I actually have podcast here before.
You have?
One other time.
This is your go-to place. I mean, there's a lot of benefits.
Yeah, that is true. But I was here with Martha Shane and Lana Wilson.
Oh, great. Yeah, I love that film.
Yeah, with After Tiller.
After Tiller.
But we're here to talk about others. Yeah, I was going through this, and maybe it's just the sheer amount of time I've been doing this, but I go through it, and I'm, like, finding person after person I love, you know, as far as being storytellers. It's just maybe it's an exceptional year or something. I don't know, but there are a lot of great films in this year, but I'm going to let you do the heavy lifting. Yeah.
Yeah, so there is an incredible amount of films this year that we saw come out of Toronto and IDFA and Sundance. You know, it's obviously trying times worldwide, and it means mm-hmm. that I think people are covering this, and there's also funding behind making strong documentaries that people can spend a little more time on.
Mm-hmm.
So we found some amazing films but this year we really tried focusing on individuals and movements that were fighting back and representing the kind of struggle and
pushing back
the tide. And yeah, we found, I think, some really strong films. We have 20 films and one additional program this year. And I'm excited about all of them, to be honest.
Well, can we just say last night I actually watched my first.
Oh, which one did you
watch? Because, you know, somebody's doing my due diligence, I have to watch as much as I can before I speak to you. And I only have time for one, but I watched The Force.
Ah, Peter Nix. Yeah.
That was good.
Wow. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm on the screening committee for a festival, and I've been watching a lot of documentaries, shorts especially, but also some features. And there's a plethora, if I can get fancy, a plethora of Black Lives Matter documentaries this year.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you probably noticed that.
Yes.
I mean,
very strong.
A lot. Yeah.
Black Lives Matter. Yeah. Well, The Who Streets is incredible. And I mean, we have also The Blood is at the Doorstep, which is a similar, but from. We kind of saw it as a pairing, mm-hmm. almost. Mm-hmm. So The Blood is at the Doorstep is following the murder of Dontre Hamilton mm-hmm. by police in Milwaukee. And that is about the family's struggle since his death to really recognize the absence of training when it comes to police dealing with men with people with mental health, because Dontre unfortunately had schizophrenia, but also obviously the attack on a young unarmed black man is not uncommon, and is I'm very glad it's being profiled in a number of really good documentaries this year. But The Force is, as you saw, the almost a companion piece in terms of showing behind the scenes in the police force to actually show where the training is lacking or the difficulties of turning it around.
The training was pretty good from what I could see on The Force, and, you know, not to get too
except
too
for the
specific.
Young trainee cops.
Well, they were
interpreting a scene very, very differently.
Well, that's the problem. See, the problem isn't necessarily in the training. It's in some of, well, could be, you could look at it as a multi, I don't want to say it's the recruits, because that's not, that's a very broad thing. But the thing is that it's so, I guess the problems, the issues are so intrinsic that, what was the original commissioner, Went?
Sounds about right.
Anyway, I don't want to get too down this foxhole because, you know, it's not the point. But it's a fascinating documentary. The Waiting Room was one of my favorites about 3 or 4 years back with Peter Nixon. I'm very excited and hoping that with Kino Lorber's assistance, I'll be getting Peter on the show very soon because we've been in touch over the years and he's so talented. And he embeds himself, which is my point. He embed himself with the Oakland Police Department during... Well, the tail end of this extraordinarily, well, in a certain time in this process of federal oversight. Yeah. It's really an incredible story. So check it out. Next up.
The Blood Is at the Doorstep is coming up actually kind of soon. It's our opening night at IFC Center and then showing the following day at Film Society. And I just wanted
to know. Those are the two locations, right?
Yeah. So we're showing from the 9th to the 18th of June. So very, very soon, next Friday. But I don't know what date
it'll
this
be
is airing.
It will be up before that, of course. What do you mean?
Well, no, I said next week, and then I don't know if it's showing.
It doesn't matter. I deliver. I can't.
It's just the timing reference I was more making.
You know, I totally understand. It's true. But I have, like with Amir, I did it overnight, Friday morning. The day of their theatrical.
I hope it did well.
Yeah.
Last week?
Yeah. Four-hour documentary.
I know, it's intense.
Do you have any four-hour documentaries in the Human Rights Watch?
Well, I mean, I guess you could call the Resistance Saga a long, extended day of screenings.
Oh, Pamela Yates' trilogy.
Yep. Sorry, just wanted to add to the Blood at the Doorstep, the entire family is going to be here with us, which we're really excited about because they're incredible. You have to come. Yeah. So the Resistance Saga is Pam Yates' new edition of 500 Years, which is the Guatemalan story throughout, I think it's over 20 years, is that right? And she has been profiling the trial of General Rios Montt and really tracking the activists who are working to get him, you know, to acknowledge the murders of many people, the indigenous population there in Guatemala. And she's done an amazing job. I mean, obviously, When the Mountains Tremble, Granito, How to Nail a Dictator, Granito, which used footage from When the Mountains Tremble to actually bring Rios Montt to trial. And now 500 Years is the kind of cap to that story. And it's going to be shown as a 3-film event on Sunday, June 11th at the film site of Lincoln Center with we're actually having a really fun event to follow it, which is live music by a Guatemalan singer and percussionist, and with some little food and wine. So
reception.
And then the ticket is only $20, and that actually includes all three films and the event. And then it's going to show one
That's
more
a great
time.
Deal.
Yeah, it's going to show one more time at IFC.
Okay.
Just 500
without
years.
Reception.
Without the events, yeah.
But still, three important films.
Yeah. Are you going to get Pam on the radio show?
I hope
show?
So. How do I do that? Well, I have her email. Maybe I...
Yeah,
but I should go through
but
the publicist.
Let you guys do that, because
then, you know... Because they're paying for publicity, and, you know, I assume. Bill Nye, science guy.
Yeah, so we, you know, obviously the news is a tough...
Not only alternate facts, but I guess that's part of... You know, questioning science as though it were up for debate.
Right. Exactly. You know, it's an opinion.
Yeah.
But also in general, you know, we really, because we're trying to focus on the empowerment aspect of human rights abuses, we're really also wanting to not, to have a spectrum of tone. So some of these films are more intense
than others.
Watching experience, I would say. But Bill Nye is a lot lighter, as you can imagine. And I didn't grow up with Bill Nye. No.
Did I?
Is it? I don't know, but it's not an English
show.
It wasn't shown in England. But I really enjoyed this film. I mean, it's not anything like his kids' show, which is now released on Netflix. But it's really looking at him as a climatologist and looking into how the impact of climate deniers is actually impacting what we are studying. So the defunding of NASA and, you know, just reduction of support for scientists out there is actually going to have long-term impact. And he's very passionate about this cause. and talks with different people along the way, Neil deGrasse Tyson and and some of the kind of stars of the other side, the kind of rich folks bankrolling these museums that show dinosaurs along with cavemen, and which drives them crazy. But yeah, it's a good film, and
I can say we currently have a caveman in the office, so it's maybe you can't say
no
that.
Dinosaurs.
Just trying to work it in, but yeah. I'm a dinosaur.
Oh, sorry, I didn't get that reference.
No, I just thought it up. So, Bill Nye Science Guy, which will be on Friday, June 9th at the IFC Center, and then the following night at 6 o'clock at the Film Society.
Yeah.
So check out that, and that could almost probably be a family. No, let's not get carried away.
Yeah. No, I think it could.
Could it?
Yeah, one of the few films that will work for younger children. I mean, it's not his kind of goofy side, which is fun, and we've seen in his kids shows and the new one on Netflix. But
well, bring your kids and then give them the tablet. You know, give them the iPad and they can watch the Netflix while the rest of us are watching the
exactly. Headphones.
No, don't do that. But City of Ghosts, I kind of want to mention that Matthew Heineman's.
Heineman. So it's. He made Cartel Land, which obviously was a big film a couple years ago. And I'd say it's a really different film, not obviously just because of content, but it's such an intimate film with the members of Rockers being slaughtered silently, which is a citizen journalism, I guess you could refer to it in a very overview-y way. But they're members of a... community in Syria that's been taken over by ISIS, and they're trying to record some of the horrific things that are happening in their town, and sneaking out this media, which is obviously extremely dangerous. And they've had targets on their back. They did manage to escape, but are facing a lot of hardship in wherever they go because of the pushback on refugees, which is just kind of a sick situation to be in. But I think it's such a beautifully made film, but
it's one of the more intense ones. It sounds like.
I would say it's an intense one, but you leave there with a lot of respect and kind of amazing admiration for these men who are risking everything, not just themselves, but their families.
And you are in the hands of a great filmmaker, too.
Yeah,
so he
did an incredible job.
You know, you're going to see a lot more from Matthew.
And he's going to be here with the film at Film Society. So I just want to say, actually, all of our films will have half an hour discussion after the...
Half hour.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's kind of a major part of the festival.
I agree with that,
It's about bringing the issues into a larger context, kind of updates on what's happening. And so we're often pairing filmmakers with Human Rights Watch researchers or other activists and...
That's great.
People in the field,
I don't get carried away, but I did a series a few years ago called Brooklyn Reconstructed, which was a kind of a micro series about... development and rezoning laws and gentrification in Brooklyn, New York City, but mostly in Brooklyn, because there was this crop of films that were coming out about four or five years ago. And we every once a month at the Ethical Society of Brooklyn in Park Slope, they gave me the place, the run of the place, and we showed a film. But it was after the films. It was those conversations, because so many people from the community would come because they're all concerned about what's going on to their neighborhoods with all the development that's going on. And so much money... That's was the arena, the complete decimation of the Fulton Mall and downtown and all these other areas, Coney Island.
Ongoing. Yeah.
Williamsburg. So these turnouts were great. Got some good press. But it was the conversations afterwards. We had community activists, community leaders, politicians.
Very cool.
Local religious leaders, journalists. I mean, it was just these conversations afterwards were so amazing, and they were at least a half hour long.
Yeah.
Sometimes longer.
No, I mean, we find that's, often what the feedback that we're getting is often the kind of reason why people are coming out to a film and that experience, because, with that amount of time, and we're working with the filmmaker to identify people that they know are working in the field. Obviously, they're their expert in whatever they've made the documentary about. And we, with them and with Human Rights Watch's knowledge of activists in the field, and we've got educators, and we've got a bunch of amazing folks in the room for each film. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a one-on-one with a filmmaker, depending on the topic. Mm-hmm. But we curate that with a lot of care and attention, and we're also, it's part of actually our outreach and impact set of objectives for the festival. Mm-hmm. So we have a year-round department just dedicated to this idea of bringing in new audiences and audiences impacted by the topic, so really,
that makes sense.
You know, not just students, but organizations that are working with this topic and how they can use the film to further their work. So, and we really try and build those bonds between filmmakers and organizations too. It's like they can take that relationship on.
It makes complete sense.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you kind of like, obviously there's a certain audience that will gravitate towards films like that are in the Human Rights, or the documentaries that are in the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. It's how do you reach those who may not necessarily be by default, you know, the audience, and how do you market and you know, attract those folks?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that mixture in it. I mean, there's like how you program. We have to, you know, not have to, but we're trying to do a bit of a spread of the more established filmmakers with newer filmmakers, with topics that are already in the news and those that don't get much coverage, as well as tone, like we were saying with Bill Nye versus City of Ghosts.
Matthew.
Yeah. We are really looking for that spectrum in order to bring people into the fold who might be interested in these issues. But also, we do a lot of student outreach and partners. You know, we partner with Tribeca, for example, and co-present films at their festival. They co-present films at ours, Rooftop Films. So we're really trying to...
FilmWax. I'm here for you.
And FilmWax, of course.
For you guys,
sorry, it wasn't the top of my list, but at the top of my mind, of course.
Well, you're not tapping me nearly enough, but
and that's also the community organizations, the grassroots folks.
Right.
That are,
I mean, down in the trenches here, on the mean streets of Gowanus here. Did you find that this, because we're in such a, it just seems like, and especially as we said at the beginning, an intense time, especially difficult time politically. It seems like the world is in a lot of especially chaotic time.
Yeah.
Every day the news lines are more horrific than the last. And I'm wondering if this actually, I'm really not phrasing this right, but you'll get my point. Does this kind of help? Like the New York Times subscriptions are up. The Nation subscriptions are up. NPR is, you know, doing great. I mean, all these organizations, is the Human Rights Watch doing? Does the benefit in a sense from the people really are seeking organizations and experiences where they can find people that are concerned, like they are, you know?
I mean, I think it's a...
And getting information.
We're in the middle of
real
it,
information.
Of knowing how that's going to unfold. In terms of Human Rights Watch, I know we've been thinking about messaging, right? I mean, like, how are people absorbing that news, and what's the largest impact we can have? So we have a multimedia department at Human Rights Watch that makes videos and short films following researchers, for example, and we're finding that those will often get more bites than a full-on report. Mm-hmm. So it's about there we go. So it's about the combination of how we're communicating. And in terms of audiences and for the film festival, we're still kind of seeing. I think that seeing what general, more broad film festivals are actually covering in terms of how they were programming. We saw a lot more human rights and social justice films come out this year.
Yeah.
And as a festival that focuses on it, is the only thing we focus on, we're seeing, you know, audiences come out that maybe weren't as informed about that topic, which we hope will be the case. Mm-hmm. But there's also, you know, an awareness of being very saturated with the news. So that's why we're trying to profile on the more positive aspects of people actually taking charge of the situation and not all being oppressed by a situation.
Yeah,
so it's hopefully something that you'll want to go see rather than something that you feel you should go see.
Understood.
So I think we have some really high quality films. I mean, there's films like The Good Postman, which is just such an odd, quirky film about a Bulgarian postman that's running for mayor, the post of mayor, and it's a tiny aging town, and it's amazing faces in there who are all debating about whether they want to open up their village to Syrian refugees. And it's, although it sounds heavy in topic, it's just such a fun film because you're seeing that human aspect of you know, old women in their 90s being like, I want some young blood around. Like, why wouldn't we open our doors and our schools to young kids? And so, yeah, there's a really, we're trying to infuse that idea of That's it doesn't have to always be beat you over the head.
Thank God for grannies. Yeah, thank
yeah, God for real.
Well, and I think we're running out of time, but Leah Sapin is the senior programmer at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which is what we're talking about, which is, runs again in New York City, the New York edition anyway. The London edition does not run in New York City at this point yet, but from the 9th of, through the 18th of June, and you can go to, of course, ff.hrw.org to get tickets, which I'm sure are available right now for purchase, as well as following on Twitter at HRW Film Festival and know, hashtag HRWFF.
It's true.
FYI. Not at the FYI part. well, anyway, I know we barely tapped into it, but maybe in the I'll mention a few more films in my intro.
Great.
We'll be promoting.
And hopefully you can see some more films before the festival.
Or during.
Yeah.
I mean, it just depends, you know.
Yeah, no, Film Society and IFC is where we are right. for that week. opening night is Nowhere to Hide It. Film Society, closing night is Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press at IFC.
Very good. Thank you so much. We'll come back on soon, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. I appreciate it. We'll be back in a couple of days with my wrap-up from the Maryland Film Festival. I still haven't put that up. I'm such a bad podcaster. Shame on me. Shame on me. I'm sorry about that, but that will be up in a couple of days, and we have lots more great, of course, podcasts coming up in the future. Please stick around. Continue to listen. FilmWax Radio is part of the Showbiz Studios podcast network and presented by Rooftop Films. Please do take care of yourself and the ones you love. Until next time. Broken lines, broken strings.